LED was positioned at just the right angle to rake the road with its 700 3.2mm steel ball bearings, which would shred everything in their path at 1,200 meters per second. The convex mine was concealed under a bed of pine straw at the base of a tree. Its wire was buried along the path. Vitya carried a green plastic firing device in his jacket pocket. He'd used the M40 test set included with the mine to confirm that it was working properly and would send the electric pulse necessary to power the blasting cap and fire the mine's plastic explosive. He couldn't risk a premature explosion, so he would only connect the detonator when he had confirmation that the target was on his way. It would be a shame if the bait was caught in the powerful blast. He hadn't even had a chance to sample the goods, but that couldn't be helped. Every battle had collateral damage. He looked down at the AKM slung at his side. It was spray-painted in a green and brown camouflage pattern to eliminate the glossy shine that had burnished through the original finish by years of rough use. After spending the preceding weeks with the iconic weapon, he had become interested in its origin and often wondered about the stories it could tell. Its stamped steel receiver differentiated it from a true AK-47, though that name would forever be associated with Kalashnikov's deadly design. He saw the arrow in triangle proof mark of the Ijevsk Armory, the small arms factory turned machine-building plant that had armed Russia's fighting men and women with everything from muskets to machine guns since the early 19th century. Behind the arsenal mark was the year the rifle was built, 1975. Vitya was younger than his weapon. The name Ricardo had been carved into the wooden buttstock by one of its previous users, trench art from the latter days of a Cold War battlefield now relegated to the pages of history. Ricardo was probably a Sandinista, given the weapon's Central American pedigree, but due to the widespread distribution of Russian weapons, Vitya couldn't be sure.
Was Ricardo waiting to ambush a group of CIA-backed Contras when boredom took over and he decided to carve his name into his weapon? Had Ricardo survived?
Vitya would never know. Chapter 31. Kumba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. Rhys awoke early, his body unaccustomed to the warmth of someone else in his bed. He didn't move, not wanting to disturb Katie's sleep as she lay on her side next to him. She looked peaceful, her face content, the rhythmic rising and falling of her bare shoulder the only movement. He watched her for an eternity in the semi-darkness, taking in every detail. A tiny gold cross hung askew around her neck on a wire-thin chain. Rhys felt a sense of harmony that he hadn't known since his family was taken from him. As the sun shone through the crack in the bedroom's heavy curtain, she stirred, her hand sliding across the cotton sheet until it found the musculature of his bare chest. She opened her eyes and smiled at him, sliding her leg toward his own and pulling herself into his embrace.
"Good morning," she purred.
Afterward, they lay side by side, Katie running her fingers over Rhys's lean chest and stomach, tracing the outline of each muscle with her fingers.
"How did you manage to spend almost 20 years in the military and walk away without a tattoo?"
"That was probably my greatest accomplishment," Rhys smiled.
"Ha! Let's eat. I'm starving."
After bringing in split logs and stoking the coals in the stone fireplace to take off the morning chill, they ate a breakfast of scrambled eggs and fruit before packing a lunch and heading for the mountain. Rhys led the lakeside hike uphill to one of the small tributaries that fed the larger body of water. They fished each pool in the rocky creek from below, out of the trout's line of sight, working their way uphill as they went. Katie looked like she'd been born with a fly rod in her hand, the sunlight filtering through the trees and catching the long leader as it S-curved its way through the air
before settling onto the water's surface. They pushed off their waders and ate their lunch in a sunny meadow, taking in the midday warmth as they drank 75 Wine Company Sauvignon Blanc from enameled metal cups. They made love under the cloudless sky before dozing on the blanket Reese had spread out on the hillside. Katie caught the first trout of the day that afternoon, a beautiful rainbow that she held up for a photo before they put it on ice in the soft-sided Yeti cooler that had carried their lunch. She caught two more fish to Reese's one as the day progressed, which led to an amusing discussion of his angling abilities. That evening, Reese drove her to one of his favorite spots on the ranch, a high vista where they sat on his tailgate drinking local micro-brews as the elk herds grazed into the grassy valley below. Katie slipped on Reese's jacket as the sun fell beneath the next ridge. In the coming weeks, the bulls would begin to rut, filling the mountain air with the enchanting sound of their bugles. The young bulls were already acting the part, posturing and chasing one another half-heartedly, as the mature males watched patiently from the timber. Back at the cabin, Reese pan-fried the breaded trout fillets while Katie stood at the stove beside him, preparing a dish of Brussels sprouts mixed with bacon. They selected a silver oak Cabernet from Napa Valley as Katie recounted how her skill with a fly rod had put their dinner on the table. As what was one of her best days in memory came to a close, Katie's eyes once again took in the room and came to rest on her suitor's back right hip. It had not gone unnoticed that Reese was never out of arm's reach of a weapon. Chapter 32. Flathead Valley, Montana. After two cold nights spent in the mountains, Dimitri's men were beginning to bitch. Despite their training, he had to remember that these men were street thugs, not soldiers, and were unfamiliar with prolonged physical suffering and hardship. He cursed Yvonne for not figuring out a way to bring professionals in to handle the hit. They'd camped in a patch of thick timber without even the luxury of a fire. Each morning he had led them to their overwatch position and waited for the call from Vitya that would initiate the second phase of the operation, the elimination of Rafe Hastings. They were 400 yards from the Land Rover and its sole occupant, Rafe Hastings. They watched him climb a ridge and stare through his telescope at some distant object. Dimitri studied the man through binoculars, careful not to risk any lens glare that would give away his position. He moved like one of the mountain lions that were known to inhabit the area, light on his feet yet powerful, covering rough ground swiftly and efficiently. Still, he only carried a handgun, a short-range weapon against a half-dozen men with rifles. Add in the element of surprise and their advantage of holding the high ground, and it wouldn't even be a contest. Even if their target got lucky and took out one or two of them, Dimitri's team would overwhelm him with sheer firepower. It was the Russian way. Dimitri suppressed a smile, thinking of Stalin's adage, "Quantity has a quality all its own." All they needed now was the signal to execute. Dimitri checked the sat phone for the 100th time that morning, ensuring it was powered up and had a strong signal. He resisted the temptation to call the other team and see what the holdup was, but the rules were clear. His team was not to engage until it was confirmed the first target had been terminated. What had he heard in one of the American movies he was so fond of? Terminate with extreme prejudice. Dimitri liked that. He watched the disappointment on his men's faces as their target collapsed the legs of his tripod, strapped the optic back onto his day pack, and moved toward his vehicle. It was the second day in a row that they'd had him in their sights, completely unaware of their presence, and were forced to let him slip away. How long could their luck hold out? As the Rover's 2.5-liter turbo diesel engine grunted to life, Dimitri signaled the men to move back, pulling them to the concealment and relative security of the thick evergreen forest. If the signal came before tomorrow morning,
They would move as quickly as possible overland and hit him at home. Doing so would give up many of their tactical advantages, but it would be their only option. The order to kill would come soon enough. Chapter 33. Coomba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. It was Sunday before Reese was finally willing to share Katie Buranek with the Hastings family. Rafe's mother Caroline had arranged a lunch to welcome Reese's friend to the ranch, and attendance was non-negotiable. Reese and Katie went on a long hike that morning, and Katie, who was raised to never show up at someone's home empty-handed, took the opportunity to gather wildflowers that she'd assembled into an impressive arrangement of glacier lily, clematis, and purple asters upon their return to the cabin. "Awful quiet over there," Reese said as they made the short drive up to the main house. "After all you've told me about his family, from the Rhodesian Bush Wars to the Celis Scouts and everything they've accomplished in this country, I'm more excited than anything else. And Rafe's father-in-law is Senator Tim Thornton, of all people. I feel like we are going to meet royalty."
"They will be more intrigued by you and your family's story. Nothing to worry about. Besides, Jonathan is probably already drunk."
"Ha, okay. My kind of people."
As they rounded the corner toward the homestead, the lake and dock came into view, the Grumman Albatross rocking gently at its mooring.
"Whose plane is that?" Katie asked in astonishment.
"That's Thorne's. He flies it in from one of his surrounding properties in Montana or Idaho. He's here for opening day tomorrow morning. He hasn't missed one since..." Reese paused. "Since his wife died."
They pulled up in front of the house and Katie let Reese open the door for her. She was pleasantly surprised when he took her arm in his as they walked toward the home's sprawling front porch, the simple gesture helping put her at ease. Jonathan and Caroline greeted the couple with genuine joy, both hugging her before she could get through the door. True to his reputation, Jonathan held a green bottle of Namibian Windhoek Lager in his paw and handed another to Reese as he entered the foyer. A man who reminded her a bit of an older Indiana Jones rose from a leather chair by the fireplace and extended his hand.
"Ms. Buranek, Tim Thornton, I am very pleased to meet you."
"It's an honor to meet you, Senator."
"Please call me Thorn. I much prefer that. Senator conjures up too many memories of my time in the swamp," he said, referring to Washington's unofficial moniker. "And thank you for your series of articles and the book on the Benghazi mess," he continued, shaking his head. "Those boys deserve better. Politicians in and out of uniform left them to die. But enough unpleasantness. Let's get you a drink."
"What can I offer you, Katie?" Caroline Hastings asked. "What are you having, Mrs. Hastings? Please call me Caroline. I'm having champagne. That sounds wonderful."
Jonathan appeared with a crystal flute of France's finest and handed it to their guest.
"We have one other surprise for you both," he said. "Liz, would you be a dear and join us?"
Reese's eyebrows arched in amazement as all 5 feet 4 inches of Elizabeth Riley appeared from a back guest room. The two had first met in Iraq during the height of the insurgency. Riley's OH-58 Kiowa had been shot down in Najaf, her capture and torture seemingly inevitable. A few blocks away, Reese's sniper team was set up in an overwatch position of a heavily IED'd stretch of road. Hearing the situation on the radio, Reese defied orders and launched a hastily organized rescue, putting the aviator deeply in his debt. She recovered from her injuries, but was medically retired from the Army. She became like a sister to Reese and his late wife, Lauren, and a close aunt to their daughter, Lucy. Riley was unflinchingly loyal to her friends, and when Reese needed help avenging the deaths of Lauren and Lucy, she was there on wings.
"Liz, what are you doing here?" Reese asked after a strong embrace.
"I work for Thorne now," she replied in her thick southern accent. "He has more planes than he can keep track of."
"Liz, you remember Katie?"
"Of course, we've kept in touch. It's not every day you spirit a kidnapped reporter off Fisher's Island in a pilatus in the middle of the night."
The two women embraced like old friends.
"Come out and have a seat. Caroline has everything set up out back," Jonathan said,
leading his guests through the home and onto the back deck via the open French doors. A long table flanked with wicker chairs had been set up on the back lawn overlooking the lake. The table was covered with a flawless white starched tablecloth of fine linen and place settings of the family's best English silver and bone china were located at each seat. Brightly colored fresh flowers, now including the ones that Katie had brought, overflowed from a vase at the table's center. Jonathan had just pulled out a chair for Katie when Rafe and Annika came strolling across the lawn.
"Katie, I'd like you to meet my friends, Rafe and Annika Hastings."
She rose, shaking hands with Rafe.
"So nice to meet both of you. I've heard so much about you."
Annika hugged her warmly.
"We're just glad that you were real, Katie. I was beginning to think that you were a figment of Reese's imagination," Rafe said with a grin.
"We promise not to scare you off, Katie,"
Annika added, elbowing her husband in the ribs.
"Please, everyone sit,"
Caroline said, before taking her seat at the far end of the rectangular table from Jonathan. Both younger couples sat beside one another, arranged so the women could chat at one end of the table while the men gathered at the other. Jonathan and Caroline brought the meal out in courses, each with an appropriate wine pairing. Rafe drank sparingly. Opening day of archery season was the following morning, and he had work to do. Reese and Katie had no such obligations. They both joined in the festivities with Thorne, Liz, and the elder Hastingses, enjoying the fine South African vintages.
"Don't be afraid to try my famous hot sauce," Jonathan reminded the table. "Goes great with everything."
"Don't believe him," Rafe warned. "He makes it with homegrown ghost peppers. If you value your taste buds, you'll shy away."
The conversation was light and jovial, much of it surrounding humorous stories from Reese's and Rafe's younger days.
"Does Katie know about your crazy Alaskan adventure, Reese?"
Jonathan prodded.
I don't think I've mentioned it yet," Reese responded.
"Alaskan adventure?"
Katie asked.
"Yeah, how long did that insane escapade take you?"
Rafe teased.
3 months, wasn't it?"
64 days,
Reese responded, shaking a finger at his friend.
"Oh, do tell,"
Katie pushed.
"I'll tell you,"
Jonathan jumped in, ever the storyteller.
"Your man here, Katie, he decides he wants to spend some time in Alaska before he ships off for boot camp. His father, Tom, God rest his soul, had a trapper's cabin in the middle of nowhere up there, so Reese had a bit of experience in austere conditions, but of course he wanted to take things to the next bloody level. He decides he wants to trek across, what was it, Reese, the Talkeetna Glacier?"
"Close,"
Reese smiled, looking sideways at Katie.
"Doesn't matter,"
Jonathan continued.
"This wild bloke decides he's going to head into the Alaskan wilderness alone. Trek across the Talkeetna Glacier to the, what river was it? No matter, to some glacial river and then kayak to the ocean."
"Kayak?" Katie asked. "Where was he going to find a kayak in the middle of the backcountry?"
"Ha! That's the best part, Katie," Jonathan went on. "He pulled it behind him over the snow."
"You did what?"
Katie asked, turning her attention back to Reese.
"Well, I had it tied to me, so if I fell in a crevasse, the idea was that the kayak would slide over the top and I'd be suspended underneath. Then I'd just jumar up and continue on."
"Jumar?" Katie asked. "Ascenders, they allow you to pull yourself up a rope. You can use a smaller piece of line and make your own as well."
"Best part is," Jonathan said, jumping back into the story. "This was before cell phones and set phones and constant connectivity. He tells us and his parents that he'll be back in a month. 64 days later, he comes kayaking into Cook Inlet, none the worse for wear, other than looking like a vagrant."
Reese shrugged. "It was a good pre-buds workout."
"And that wasn't the end of it," Jonathan continued. "This mountain man then sells his whitewater boat and mountaineering gear, buys a sea kayak, and spends a month island hopping his way around Prince William Sound."
"What did you eat?" Katie asked.
"I pulled a lot of the staples behind me in the kayak, potatoes and rice, and I hunted and fished my way across for protein. I had a little .22 in the kayak that I'd use for squirrels and beavers, and a fly rod for trout and Arctic grayling. Once in the Sound,